and I'm very excited actually to have Rock Naguna here. I've been on retreat recently with Rock Naguna, and I'm very privileged to be on a small seminar retreat at Adhisthana, looking at this material, listening to these sutras, so it was very delightful. And yeah, to have you here in Bristol Buddhist Centre is great. Yeah, you were saying you're going to write your talk on the train and thought there was nothing you haven't already said. So you have to listen to the talks online if you want to hear a talk. But yeah, we're going to have a conversation or an interview or something.
Yeah. So I thought I'd think about the talk on the train down. And I was sitting there, I just couldn't think of anything more to say. And I just couldn't get the energy up to think about another talk. And I thought, you know, the best evenings are when I've been interviewed. It's so fresh and so on. And I thought, how about if I interview myself? I thought, why would I ask myself? So I just wrote a number of questions. I thought the talk would be based on those questions. But in the team meeting, I said that, and we decided, why don't we get someone to ask me those questions?
So, so I've got the questions. Right.
Carefully selected by me.
So, would you like to say a little bit about what the Pure Land Sutras actually are?
Yeah, so... that's a very
by
good
any
question. So the so-called Pure Land Sutras... ancient Mahayana sutras. Do you all know what I mean by Mahayana sutras? Anybody know those words just going over your head? Mahayana sutras? Yeah, like that. Okay. So sutra means discourse, really. It's usually understood to mean a discourse by the Buddha, a teaching by the Buddha. And Mahayana is the second great wave of Buddhism, the great way. That's probably all you need to know. And these are part of the first two of them anyway, are part of the early stream of Mahayana sutras. Probably written down about 500 or 600 years after the Buddha lived. So there are three of these sutras. Two of them have the same title, the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras. But one's about 6 pages and one's about 70 pages. So one of them is called the shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, and the other's called, guess what? The longer Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra. And the third one was written probably a few hundred years later, 200 or 300 years after that. The first two, the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras, scholars are not sure where they originated, but probably the best guess is around what is now Pakistan, maybe even Afghanistan, the Gandhari region in Afghanistan. Probably 100 or 200 years common era. So 500 or 600 years after the Buddha, they were written. Now that doesn't mean to say that's when they were composed. They could have been composed hundreds of years earlier, but part of an oral tradition that was later written down, just as the Pali texts were. That's a possibility. The third sutra is said to be, we've only got it in Chinese now. It's the only one that's come down to us in Chinese. And at the beginning of the sutra it says, translated from the Sanskrit into the Chinese by such and such a person in such and such a year. But that probably isn't true. The original Sanskrit version has never been found. That doesn't mean say it has never existed, but most scholars think that it was written in China as if it were an Indian sutra. I wonder if you can guess why they did that. Why did they try to make out a Chinese work was an Indian work, an early Indian work? Any ideas?
Authority.
Yeah, legitimacy. If you said this came from India, it was from the Buddha, the mouth of the Buddha, then that would give it much more authority than if you said, oh, I just wrote this down myself last week. So it's said to be a translation from the Sanskrit, but probably it's written in China. So in China, there are a number of these sutras, and they are called Wei Jing. Jing is treaties. sutra, and wei is pseudo. So they're known as pseudo sutras, sutras that were written in China, and made to look as if they were imported from India. So those are the three sutras, and they're all concerned with this magical, mythical land called Sukhavati, which means the land of bliss or the land of happiness, which is the Buddha field, the pure Buddha field of the Buddha Amitabha, or Amitayus. And the myth around it all is that Amitabha kind of created this perfect world, this world made of jewels and gold and silver, for beings to be reborn there and practice the Dharma from there. Probably more will come out with more questions, but that's basically what the sutras are. Maybe I could just say as well that Divan referred to my book as about Pure Land Buddhism. Actually, it's not. It's not about Pure Land Buddhism. It's about the three Pure Land texts, which later this whole school called Pure Land Buddhism, the doctrinal foundation of Pure Land Buddhism is from these three texts. And although I have been very interested in Pure Land Buddhism, the Chinese and Japanese forms of Pure Land Buddhism, for this book, I didn't want to look at Pure Land Buddhism, what they'd made of these texts. I wanted to go right back to the texts themselves and see what they said and read them from their own point of view, sort of thing. Yeah.
So why did you write a book about?
Why? The reason I've asked Yuval and Amali to ask me that question because every time I've been interviewed, I've been asked that question. It's an obvious question to ask, isn't it? But I wanted to answer that question again tonight because I wanted to give a different answer. So in the past, I've given a very long answer, which I'm not going to give you tonight, but it's all to do with my history, my own personal history as a member of the order and how I came across the great Pure Land Japanese Buddhist, Shinran, about 15 years ago when I was having a crisis. And he himself had a crisis and turned to Pure Land Buddhism as a result. So I became very interested in Pure Land Buddhism then, and especially their emphasis on other power rather than self-power. So in my previous interviews, I've told that whole story in some detail. And then I go on to say that I'd never really looked at the text, actually. I was interested in Shinran and his thoughts, but I wasn't particularly interested in the texts, the sutras. But then I was on a solitary retreat, and I took the sutras with me, and I read them out in front of the shrine. It takes about 6 or 7 hours to read the sutras, all three sutras, read out loud. And I did that on a solitary, and really enjoyed it. And I had a book with me, and I wrote down, I could give a series of 8 lectures on these, just as Sangharaksha has given eight lecture series on other Mahayana sutras. And I came up with a whole plan of how I could do this. And then I got back to Manchester, and of course I didn't do anything because, you know, you have these ideas on retreat, and then you come back and life's too fast, isn't it? You can't follow through with everything you want to do. So I put that in the drawer and forgot about it. And then I was on retreat 3 years ago at our retreat centre at Guhyaloka, a 3-month retreat, and the idea came back to me, but this time to write a book. So that's the story, an abbreviated story of why I came to write the book. But actually, that doesn't tell you why I decided to write it. It just tells you all the background about how it came to be that I was interested in it and so on. Because one can be interested in a topic without feeling one needs to write a book about it. So I've been wondering why I decided to do that, because it was a big job. Writing that book was a very big job. It took up a lot of my time. And it was totally absorbing. And, you know, I don't really know why I did it. I was interested in Pure Land Buddhism, yeah. But what prompted me to actually decide to write a book about those texts, I don't really know. But there's one possible explanation. I don't say this is the explanation, but in Pure Land Buddhism, a few hundred years after those sutras, there was a Chinese Pure Land Buddhist called Tan Wan. And he's the one who came up with this idea of other power. Or so, you know, in Japanese Buddhism, you get this idea of self-power and other power. I don't know if you know that. And self-power is you as a person, as an individual, deciding to practice and making efforts to get up in the morning and meditate and practice ethics and study the Dharma. It's all coming from you. You're the originator of it all, yeah? But in Pure Land Buddhism, you get this idea of other power, that it's come from somewhere else. You know, even your desire to practice the Dharma, where does that come from? It's come from outside of yourself. So, as this is a book about these Pure Land texts, I've been wondering, where did that impetus to actually sit down and write a book about these texts really come from? Was it because of this and that and the other? And was it because Sangharaksha had given these lecture series on the Mahayana Sutras that I've always found very inspiring? I'm sure all of those contributed to my eventual decision, but I don't actually know where the decision to write the book came from. And I can't help wondering if it didn't come from me, whether it actually came from Amitabha, part of the other power, was just like, I'm going to write a book about these three texts. Where did that come from? I don't really know. Yeah. That's why I wanted Jwava Lamani to ask me that question, because I had never said that before. And I thought, as this is my final book launch, I thought I'd just put that on record as well.
Yeah, I can relate to that. A lot of the things that happen in life seem, you know, the big, important, dharmically engaging things seem to be a bit like, how did I come to be doing it? I don't know how I came to be chair of this centre.
No. And it's like we tell stories about ourselves, don't we? We have these narratives. We do something, and then we tell ourselves and everyone else a story of why we came to do that. It's just a story we tell ourselves. A lot of the time, I think we don't really know why we do something. It comes from somewhere else. And then we give it a kind of respectable story to be able, well, you've got to talk about it, haven't you? You can't just say, oh, it came from somewhere, don't we? So you have to say something that people can really understand. So you sort of narrate these stories to yourself of why you did something and why something happened. But actually, I'm not sure that we always know quite so clearly why we do something.
Those conditions are so numerous and various and mysterious that we can never track them all. So And do you think we needed this book? Is that an aspect? Why does the Triratna Buddhist community need a book about the sutras?
That's a good question. It's interesting that, because when I came back from Gukuloka, I know with Windhorse Publications, you can't just say, I want to write a book about something. You have to come up with a book proposal. So I wrote a book proposal. You know, it would be so many chapters, and this chapter would be this, and so on and so on. And I sent it to them, fully expecting them to go, wow, great. But they didn't. I was really surprised and disappointed, because they were very, very underwhelmed by the idea. And it took 9 months before they said yes, eventually. And one of the things that one of the trustees of Windhorse at that time had said was, well, I just don't think Pure Land Buddhism is relevant to the modern West. So that really surprised me, actually. There were two things that this particular person had said. One was that, and the other was, I'm not sure that a book like this would sell. Now, I can understand that second one, because I wasn't sure how well a book on these Pure Land texts would sell. I thought, yeah, okay, I'm not sure how well it will sell either. But I didn't really understand the first one. I was surprised that she'd said that she doesn't think that the Pure Land texts are relevant to us in the West. It gave me quite, you know, I began thinking about it, because it really surprised me, because I thought, of course they're relevant. And I had to quite try and think into how could they not be relevant? And So, obviously, I do think they're relevant. I didn't want to spend a year and a half writing a book that's completely irrelevant to people. So it meant a lot to me. So I began to think, what is it? How can anybody think they're not relevant? And, of course, there are many reasons why you might think that. They were written or composed in India or China 1,000 or so years ago. So how relevant could they be to us? They're about this mythical place, this country called Sukhavati, where the ground is golden, or lapis lazuli, depending on which sutra you're reading. And the trees are made of gold and silver and sapphire and ruby and emerald. And magical birds sing the Dharma. The Buddha's sitting there, doesn't say a word. He just sits there. And all the teachings come from the land. So there are these birds that sing the Dharma to you. And the rivers that go, massive rivers that go, run through the land, and they murmur the Dharma to you. And musical instruments that are in the sky play the Dharma to you. So you're hearing the Dharma all the time, but not from the Buddha. That's the kind of place it is. So now you're beginning to probably think, yeah, I can understand that this may not be relevant to modern, contemporary Westerners. So, how are they relevant? I've given myself a hard job now, haven't I, to say how they're relevant. For me, the important thing about them is that they tell you about the Dharma, they describe the Dharma, they describe awakening to us in a completely different way than the way probably you're used to. It's interesting, there's a wonderful book called The Land of Bliss by an American scholar called Luis Gomez. He's retired now, but he wrote this, well, the book, The Land of Bliss, is basically his translations of the two Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras. He translated them twice each, once from the Sanskrit and once from the Chinese, because they're rather different from each other. He did that, but also lots of really lovely introductory material. And one of the points he makes in his introductory material is that we Westerners, the kind of Buddhism that we have been introduced to, is of a particular kind. He calls it the high tradition. It's an interesting way of putting it, the high tradition. The high tradition is very much to do with intellectual understanding and meditation. Yeah. Now, you probably recognise that because, you know, a lot of the Buddhism that we are familiar with is all to do with conceptual formulations of the Dharma. The five spiritual faculties, the Eightfold Path, the three marks of conditioned existence, and so on and so on. And we're used to that and we study that kind of thing. And what else do? We come into shrine rooms and we meditate. We meditate silently. We get taught how to do the mindfulness of breathing, the metta-bhavana, just sitting. And we sit here silently together. So that's the kind of Buddhism that's been introduced to us in the West. You go to the East and apparently it's quite different. Let's take the example of Pure Land Buddhism because Devan mentioned that. And do you know that there are more Pure Land Buddhists in the world than any other denomination of Buddhism? Yeah. And what do we know about Pure Land Buddhism? Hardly anything. Hardly anything at all. How has that happened? How can it be that Buddhists in the West know hardly anything about the biggest form of Buddhism in the East? Yeah. Why don't we know? Well, partly because the books that have been written and translated into English are not Pure Land Buddhist books. But then another question arises, why not? Why have we had so many Tibetan treatises translated into English? Why have we had so much, well, the whole of the Pali Canon translated into English, and how many Pure Land books have been translated into English? Hardly anything. How has that come about? Well, I think it's because we in the West, most of us who are Western Buddhists, we don't want very much to do with Christianity or any theistic tradition. Is that correct? Yeah. We don't really want God and heaven. Yeah. Now, to a Westerner, when they read the Pure Land text, it looks too close to God in his heaven. Yeah? You've got Amitabha in this Pure Land, and you get reborn there after death. Now that looks very, very similar to something else we're used to, doesn't it? And I think that's one of the reasons, maybe the main reason, why we Westerners are not interested in Pure Land Buddhism. And often Westerners think of it as a degeneration of Buddhism. It's Buddhism gone theistic. So that's, I think, the main reason why we're not interested in it. And it's very faith-based. I had a girlfriend a few years ago, and her mother was a practicing Christian. And her mother and father came to see us in Manchester, and we showed them the Buddhist Centre. And Leslie, the mother, was looking at the book section, the bookshop, and she was opening books. And she came back and she said, "Oh, it's all very intellectual, isn't it?" And I can understand that. I thought, actually, it is. Yeah, it's quite intellectual, our form of Buddhism. In the East, it's very, very different from that, especially in Pure Land Buddhism. They don't really do that kind of thing. It's very much to do with faith, and it's very much to do with surrender, hence other powers, surrendering yourself to the Dharma. And it's something that we Western Buddhists don't really want to really pay much attention to. But I think it's... I know what the next question is, so I can go on. I think it's the next question or the one after anyway. Writing this book was really quite something to do. I had read the sutras before, but probably only once, I think. That time on that Soul Retreat, I read them out loud and got quite excited about them, but probably hadn't read them again. So I didn't really know them. So writing the book wasn't just a matter of writing down what I already knew and putting it into order. It was a matter of exploring something that I didn't know very well. And it took an awful lot of reflection. So I wrote the whole thing in an armchair. And I have the book and my computer. And I'd read one of the texts. I'd read a part of it and think, what is that actually? What's going on there? What can I write about that? What does it mean? How can I explain it to myself, let alone other people? So it was a job of a lot of reflection and contemplation. So a lot of the time I wasn't actually writing. I was looking at the text and thinking, what can I say about that? What can I write about that? Well, before I can write anything about it, I have to have something to say, you know. So I'd be sitting there with the book, reflecting. And then my meditations, my morning meditations, were dominated by the texts, by the imagery in the text. And very often I would actually meditate on the text that I'd been writing about, because they're very imaginal. They describe something which you don't find here in the world. So I'm sitting there really reflecting and meditating. And I came to the conclusion that the text, although the text is called, my book is called Great Faith, Great Wisdom, because I had to come up with a title before I wrote the book. And I thought the book was going to be about mainly faith. And really what I wanted to say, that in the Pure Land text, faith is wisdom. There's no difference. They're just two different sides of the same coin. Faith and wisdom are the same thing. So I thought that was what the book was going to be about. But when I actually really looked into the book, I realised it was about the imagination. That the texts are about the imagination. They're a very highly imaginative way of describing the awakened state. What they're doing is, they're not books that you sit in an armchair and read, like you might read one of Sangharakshita's books, or Devan's book on conditioned code reduction, or my book on reflection, or a novel. They're not really meant to be read silently. They were written, at least the two Sagsukhavibhuha sutras, were written at the very beginning of the writing down of the Dhamma. In other words, they were at the cusp between an oral society and the beginnings of a literate society. Do you know that reading silently is a fairly recent phenomenon? Yeah. We haven't been doing it for very long. You know, when you're a child, you read everything out loud, don't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the way everyone used to read. Reading was communal. You read out loud. But now we do it silently in solitude. Yeah. We read and we don't say a word out loud. We just read something. But that's fairly new. It's only in the last... Does anybody know how long it's been? 100 years? Longer?
Mm. Well, Jane Austen must have relied on... Jane Austen's novels must have relied on people reading in solitude, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Would they read them silently?
Mm-hmm. Imagine so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Who knows? Mm. But anyway, I do know that that hasn't always been the case, and certainly at the time these were written, they weren't meant to be read silently. People didn't have them in their homes and read them. They're ritual objects. They're meant to be read out loud. They're meant to be read ritually. And that's why it had such a big effect on me to read them on my solitary retreat. I was reading them as they were meant to be read. In other words, I was reciting them out loud. And then at Kishiloka last year, I was on a month-long retreat, and I decided to record them so that if you buy the book, you can, you've got access to the recordings of them on the Windhorse website. So I read them out loud, and I used to read them about 11 o'clock in the morning. There was a double meditation, one at 11 and one at 12, and I would not go to the 11 o'clock meditation, I'd sit in my hut, and I'd read the sutra out loud between 30 and 40 minutes, recording it. And then I'd go straight into the shrine room. And it had such a good effect on me. I was so ready to meditate once I'd got there. Well, I was already meditating. So, you know, even on retreat, you get into the shrine room and it takes a while to settle. I don't know how long it takes you to settle to meditate, but I spend an awful lot of time getting ready to meditate once I sit down. And sometimes the bell's gone for the end by the time I'm ready. You know, I'm sitting, oh, yeah, come on. I'm doing that for a lot of time. But reading the sutras is remarkable because, in a way, the work's done for you. To read the sutra, you have to concentrate. You have to concentrate on reading. So that's one thing. You're immediately concentrated because you have to read what the text says. So you become concentrated. And you're using your breath. So it's a bit like the mindfulness of breathing. You have to breathe in, and then you, when you breathe out, you're saying out the words of the text. And the words of the text are wonderful and beautiful and mysterious and marvellous and sometimes funny as well. And it's all Dharma, it's all descriptions of awakened states of mind in highly imaginative terms. So instead of saying the first jhana, the first meditative absorption has five factors, you know, I can't remember what they are now, vitakka and vichara, initial thought and sustained thought or attention, etc., etc. Instead of doing that, it describes ponds, yeah? Beautiful ponds with clear water and beautiful lotuses on. Because in the texts, water imagery means, I think, meditation. Water imagery is meditation. For instance, in the Longa Sutra, the rivers. You can walk into the rivers, and you can walk into the rivers up to your ankles, or up to your knees, or up to your hips, or up to your ears. Four levels. Now, isn't that funny? Four levels of immersion into the water. You've probably heard about total immersion retreats, which are meditative retreats. Where does that come from? You immerse into the water. So, immersing yourself into the water, for me, means immersing yourself in meditation. So, to get back to reading the sutras out loud, they're highly imaginative. They awaken your imagination. So that, when I went into the shrine room to sit down to meditate, I was concentrated. I was aware of my breath. I was aware of my body. And my imagination had been awakened. The only way I can put it, it was something like a coloured concentration. Mm-hmm. Get that? It was coloured concentration. Yeah. I can't remember what question I was answering.
No, I think you've just answered two or three.
Oh, okay.
So you said the book, although it's called Great Faith. great wisdom's mostly about imagination. How would you define imagination?
Years ago, in fact, 1981, I had the great privilege to be in Tuscany. Specifically, I spent 3 months in a convent, Il Convento, right in the south of Italy, just on a hill near a village called Batignano. We could see Batignano from where we were. And it belonged to a man called Adam, who bought this place, and he was very interested in opera, especially early opera, Baroque opera, and he used to have a season of opera there every summer. People would come from all over the world to listen to these Baroque operas in these beautiful surroundings. A member of our order was an old friend of his, and so we got to use the place for 3 months. Immediately after the operas, we had the place September, October, November. And Sangraccia decided we would run 3 month ordination retreats there, and I was invited to be part of the team for that first ordination retreat in 1981. So there we were with Sangraccia doing a lot of teaching, at one point he just started talking about the imagination, and he was talking about the Mahayana and faith in the Mahayana, and he was saying that he thought that in the Mahayana faith was tantamount to the imagination. Yeah, which is a really amazing thing to drop in to a retreat, that faith is imagination. And we were talking quite a lot about it for obvious reasons. And he went on to define what he meant by the imagination. He said, I don't mean the imagination in the normal sense of the word, where, you know, imagine yourself walking down the road, you know, imagine yourself having a new job, etc., etc. He doesn't mean it on that kind of more mundane level. He meant it on a higher level. And he called it the imaginal faculty, to distinguish it from the ordinary imagination, the imaginal faculty. And he said, you can imagine it a bit like this, that it's reason and emotion. You know, reason and emotion, we think of them as head and heart, don't we? And we often think of ourselves, that reason and emotion are kind of split. There's a divide between reason and emotion. And sometimes we can experience that very fully, can't we, when you know you should do something. It's best for everyone if you do this. And then you go and do something else. Yeah? You've been in that situation? You know you should do this, but you do something else. You know you definitely shouldn't do that. That is not the thing to do. And then you go and do it. Yeah? So your reason and emotion are not integrated. You know, the reason tells you this is the best thing to do, and your emotions decide to do something else. Yeah? But part of the first stages of the spiritual life is to bring yourself together. You become concentrated, you become absorbed into one whole. You become whole as a person, you become integrated. Reason and emotion become integrated. And what he went on to say was that when reason and emotion become integrated, they become a higher faculty. It's as if they come together like this and they do this, yeah, in a higher faculty, which is called the imagination. So the imagination is reason and emotion perfectly integrated, but more than simply reason and emotion. And you begin to perceive the world through the imagination. You begin to perceive the world imaginatively. It's interesting that we actually do perceive the world imaginatively all the time. I was in Sao Paulo this time last year, a conference. I met a very interesting man called Luis Lopez, who is a scientist, works in Brazil. And he'd just given a presentation, which unfortunately I'd missed, but I just got there in time to listen to him answer questions. And his answers to the questions were very interesting, so I got talking to him afterwards. And he was talking about the imagination. And he was saying that we know now, neuroscientists know, that a lot of what we thought we used to think we perceive, we don't actually perceive. We imagine to be there. Interesting thing is, we don't actually know what's out there. Yeah, we don't really know what's out there. We know there is things out there, because if I do that, my foot won't my foot stops at the floor, doesn't it? I can't put my foot through the floor. So there's something there, isn't it? But what it is out there, we don't really know, because we can't get outside of our... We can only sense it through our senses, and we can only process it through our limited brain. We can't get outside of our brain and our senses to see what's really there. So we're kind of stuck. We don't really know what's there. Anyway, Luis Lopez was talking about this. And I said, that's really interesting. I've just written this book, because I had just written it at that point. And it's about Pure Land Buddhism, and it's all about the imagination. He said, oh, so what's Pure Land Buddhism? And I told him about Sukhavati, this land of, you know, gold trees and lapis lazuli ground and magical birds. And he said, ah, he got really excited by this. He said, ah, if just one person visualises Sukhavati, it's in their imagination. If two people visualise it, they've created a world. Yeah? So you create a world together.
Yeah.
And he talked about the phenosphere and the biosphere. So the phenosphere, let's talk about biosphere first. The biosphere is the world we collectively imagine. Yeah? The world that we... that wall's green, right? And these walls look like they're white to me. Yeah, and there's a ceiling, isn't there? So we share that, yeah? We're in the same biosphere. But each one of us has their own phenosphere, which is their own particular imagining of the world, which is made up of everything that's happened to us in the past, all the things that we've done, all the imaginings that we've had, all our memories. We build up our own small world as well within the bigger world. So we already largely imagine the world that we're in. And in the writing of the book, in the thinking about the sutras, I began to feel the spiritual life in a different way than the one I had before. There was like a shift, an important, for me, shift. You know, when we're talking about Buddhism, we talk about the path leading to awakening. And there are stages of awakening, aren't there? There's stream entry, for instance. And we talk about insight, how we gain insight. And insight, we all know what insight is, don't we? Even if we've never had insight, we know what books say about it and teachers say about it. You begin to see things clearly. You really see that things are impermanent, yeah? You really understand that there is no self, yeah? Those are the big markers of the spiritual life, aren't they? When you really see these things. The Pure Land texts, I'm not interested in that. It's very, very interesting. They're just not interested in that way of seeing the spiritual life. I think impermanence is mentioned, it's not mentioned at all, or no self. It's not mentioned in the first of the three sutras, but that's only 6 pages. Maybe they couldn't get it in. But then the next one is 70 pages long. Impermanence and no self are mentioned, I think, twice. Once the rivers say it as they go past, impermanence, no self. And then it's in a list of things a bit later on. But they don't go into them at all. And then the third one is the same, hardly anything at all. Basically, they're not interested in the self and the seeing through the self. They're just not interested. What they're interested in is awakening your imagination. What if... This is what I began to wonder. What if the way we conceive of the spiritual life is limited, very limited? Of course, it's bound to be, isn't it? But wonder, what if our biospherical understanding of the spiritual life that we all share, which is about a path leading to insight, and that insight will be a realization, an understanding of something you didn't understand before. What if that's very limited? What if that moment that we call insight is not so much seeing clearly for the first time as imagining more vividly? What if it's that? Yeah. What if the spiritual life isn't really about seeing clearly? What if it's really about imagining much more greatly? Yeah, because that's what the texts seem to tell me. That it's about imagining the world we're in much better. I often ask people these days, what kind of world do you imagine yourself to be in? Yeah. Why don't you try to imagine it better? Yeah. Imagine the world you're in better. Yeah. So these weird descriptions, these strange, almost bizarre descriptions of a land with a gold, where the ground is golden and trees are made of sapphire, for instance, or emerald, and lotuses are miles, they're miles big, right? And out of these lotuses come 36 trillion rays of light from each petal. And at the end of each one of these rays of light, there are 36 trillion Buddhas. Yeah? Can you imagine that? And what if insight were not so much, oh, now I understand that all things are impermanent, as now I'm standing in the presence of all the Buddhas. Yeah? Imagine if the world were the whole universe were populated by Buddhas, and your insight was to realize that Buddhas are everywhere. Yeah? That Buddhahood is all around us. It's all around us. And the problem that we've got is we do not see that. Yeah? We won't allow ourselves to realize that the Buddha and the Dharma is everywhere, and it's kind of knocking at the door. Yeah? It's knocking at your door, and you keep the door firmly closed. What if the spiritual life was about that? And you feel safe in your little house. Nothing can get at you, but of course you're not really safe. You know what can happen to houses. Anything can happen to houses, can't it? Lightning, earthquakes. And you're sitting in your house feeling safe, but actually you're not really safe, but you're closed off. There's a wonderful... I sent a text to my girlfriend on the way down here on the train. This is a really long answer, isn't it?
That's all right, you've covered all the questions.
And I just wrote to her and I said, I'm trying to think of what to say tonight, I can't think of anything, so I decided I'm going to do an interview with myself. So if you've got any questions, send them to me. Now, why am I telling you that? She said, what's your favourite image in the sutra? That's right, that's one of the questions she would ask me if she was going to interview me. So I'll tell you one of my favourite images. You're in Sukhavati, right, in this land. You've just been born there, but you've been born within a closed lotus. You're inside this lotus, yeah, there you are, and you're in this lotus, so you're nice and safe. The lotus is keeping you all safe. So it's like, the lotus is like a sheaf of selfhood, right? Keeping you in it. But you're in Sukhavati, but you cannot hear the birds singing. You can't hear the rivers murmuring, no self, impermanence, peace. You cannot see the sapphire trees or the 36 trillion rays of light coming from the lotus. You can't see or hear anything of that. You can't smell the aromas. You can't feel the breezes of the air, yeah? You're in this lotus. So it's one of the meditations in the third sutra. There are 16 meditations. One of them is you imagine yourself in this lotus. So there you are, all closed up in this lotus. And then you imagine the lotus opening, yeah? The petals open. And it streams into you, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, stream in. The beautiful music played by the instruments in the air, the sound of the birds, the breezes, the aromas. And you can see the Buddha. It's all coming in. And it just opens like, that's one of my favourite images. And I've done it quite a few times. We did it, didn't we? We did it on the retreat we did. It's a marvellous thing to do. Now, I was going to ask you to say a few words, wasn't I? So, how did you get on with that particular practice? Do you remember?
I don't remember that one being particularly I love like the idea of it, like listening to you talking about it, I love it, but I don't think I particularly got on with it as a visualisation when we did it that time. But some of the others in that sutra I did get quite concentrated in. It was very funny, wasn't it, when we listened to the sutras all read in the shrine room, and often we were laughing a lot, which was a surprise.
It was.
But yeah, we have.
Or do we have to stop now?
I'm afraid we do, sadly. Oh, okay. But yeah, I'm just so excited and inspired every time I hear that kind of reimagining of what the spiritual life is for. It's just so delightful. So thank you for that. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Really lovely.
Thank you.